talk is on the second of the seven factors of awakening, interest or investigation. And one quality of mindfulness that I didn't talk about, the tenth of all of them, is the way in which mindfulness links up with wisdom. So again, if just to put an N sound to it, we could say mindfulness is in the neighborhood of wisdom. It's not necessarily wisdom. And mindfulness is just this kind of clear seeing of how things are, and that leads to wisdom. And we're not just paying attention for attention's sake, but we're paying attention for the sake of freedom from suffering in order to benefit all beings. And one of my teachers, Joseph Goldstein, writes, "For mindfulness to function as a factor of awakening, it has to be tied to this quality of interest and investigation. When mindfulness brings us face to face with the object, what do we learn? So we're not just being here now, as wonderful as that is. We're being here now to learn wisdom. And interest and investigation is the quality in our mindfulness practice that leads to wisdom. And so wisdom is essentially the lessons learned through our mindfulness practice. And really, most simply what wisdom is seeing how things work. So in the Buddhist understanding of karma, that's one way of seeing how things work. We see cause and effect, action and consequence. And it's really wisdom. It's the clear seeing of wisdom. Wisdom discriminates these differences. And with wisdom, we really see wisdom is when we're most aligned with reality. And from that, we have a sense of how to build our lives. And we build a life that recognizes our time here is very precious, extremely precious. And we use this precious time and life force to build a life that leads to more well-being and more ability to benefit and away from confusion and delusion. And it's really, we would say that mindfulness through interest and investigation leads to wisdom. So that's kind of the thread. And from wisdom, we build our lives outward. And we build a life that works, that's really in service of our deeper yearnings. So this quality of interest is really powerful and fundamental for driving our practice. And we could say that interest is a very, very wholesome motivation for our practice. If you're with something just simply because you're interested in it, that's as sustainable as it gets, right? Like, no, I'm really interested in being with this experience just as it is. And so as I explore this, there's a kind of classical definition of this factor. And that's, I'm going to use the Pali word. Dhamma vichaya. So vichaya is investigation, but it's investigation of Dhamma. So I'll say more about that. And there's another quality as part of it, which is interest. And interest is curiosity. Sometimes we're so curious, we're fascinated. So there's this interest aspect and this investigation aspect. And so the interest piece of it is just simply, it's like a quality of mind that develops with mindfulness. And then it's also a quality of mind that helps us be more mindful, because it's a motivational quality. We're interested, so we want to keep going. And that interest has, you know, sort of more and more deeper layers. So the interest, you know, can lead to passion, like spiritual passion, and a quality called chanda, which is spiritual zeal, where we're fascinated in the unfolding of our experience and how the Dharma is mapped onto our experience. And we have, you know, and that's why, you know, the next factor that comes out of interest is energy. From that interest and passion comes energy. And we could say that there's desire even in the interest. We want to know how something is. But isn't desire an unhelpful or unskillful state? No, not necessarily. These qualities, interest, passion, enthusiasm, desire, if all this is directed towards understanding how things are, understanding reality, that is really helpful. It's helpful to want to understand how your mind creates suffering and how it creates freedom. Very helpful to want to know that. Now, James Baraz, one of the senior teachers at IMS in Spirit Rock, now he's just at Spirit Rock, but he talked about Ram Dass instructing him to tell the Dharma. He's like, James, have you told the Dharma you love it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, have you said, I love you to the Dharma? And, you know, we can fall in love with the Dharma. And that's, we have great interest, because it's amazing that we have this teaching that's, you know, discovered by somebody that is, you know, it has a religious context in the tradition, but the practice of it is very practical and experiential, and it's been going 2,500 years. And the same thing that worked for the Buddha works for us to disentangle ourselves from our suffering. This is amazing. So we can let the little kid in us, you know, that has all those qualities of enthusiasm and passion and I love you, Dharma. You know, we can, we want to let that rip and rejoice, you know, in the wisdom that we're learning as we go. It's not just like, okay, check that box. Now I know how to work with my difficult emotions. Okay, got that, you know. It's like, no, this is a life skill. This is a skill for you in the rest of your life. So this interest piece, it's bound up with we're interested in our experience as it is right now, and we're also interested in deepening our ability to do this. And, you know, when practice really gets flowing, that interest is really strong, both in the moment and in the sense that, wow, you know, my life has tremendous meaning because I have this skill that I'm training in, and I'm getting better and better at being here, and it's really cool. So that's the interest part of it. The investigation piece is a little more specific. It's investigating our experience. There's two aspects. We're investigating the unfolding of our experience, the nature of our experience. And then we're investigating how the Dhamma teachings manifest in our experience. So we could call the first one the little D Dhamma. You know, Dhamma just means different things, but it means the truth of things is kind of small D, and big D is the teachings of the Buddha. So we're investigating just the truth of our experience as we understand it, and then how the Buddha's teachings on the truth manifest. So in kind of the small D, you know, when we're just observing our experience and being with the truth of things as it's unfolding for us, we have to be really clear that investigation doesn't link up with analyzing and trying to figure things out intellectually. This is a mindfulness investigation, not an analytical exercise. So that's one really important aspect. Not investigating the way a scientist investigates something. We're investigating it the way an experiencer investigates something, through the experience of mindfulness. And we're looking not so much at the content of our experience, though we definitely get insights into content, but more the process of your experience. How is your experience unfolding? Investigation is really tracking that. Just a small example, you know, just the way as you get more mindful, you start to notice the way the mind pinballs off of itself through association. You know, so I say the word tree, where does your mind go? Just notice. You know, maybe you go, I mean, my mind just went to the rose apple tree, and when the Buddha was a young child, he went into a spontaneous jhana when he was left in the shade of the rose apple tree. But maybe you mind, who knows where your mind went, but just the word tree is all your mind needs to bounce into something, and then bounce into something else, and bounce into something else. And so investigation notices the process of that. And it learns, oh wow, this mind just pinballs off itself. There doesn't need to be a me in there making all these thoughts. This brain will think thoughts all day long without needing me to be there at all. It's rude. It's not needing, you know, us to be there. Sometimes maybe it invites us to the party, but it's happy to just be at the party without us, just bouncing along, you know. The heart pumps blood. The brain pumps thoughts. That's what brains do. And the primary organizer is association. So again, investigation is noticing the process, how your experience is happening. There's another really important aspect of investigation. And we're going to come back to the interest part of it. Our interest and fascination typically is for everything we're doing in the mental sense, in the mind. We're fascinated, deeply, desperately interested in our thoughts. We don't know how not to be interested in them. And we do that to the exclusion of the five physical senses. So smelling, tasting, touching, seeing, hearing. You know, we'll flit a little bit onto those things. We're not used to being interested in the five physical experiences. And so when we're working with sensory clarity, where the primary distinction we're making is between the five physical senses and the sixth sense, in other words, the raw data coming in and then the way the mind interprets it, that's the main aspect of sensory clarity. So one thing that really helps with sensory clarity is to take this factor of interest and become really interested in your physical senses. So when we're eating our meal, we can be very interested in how the food is tasting, the texture, the temperature. We can get very interested just in the rise and fall of the belly, like, wow, isn't it interesting? You know, the belly's rising. Oh, the belly's falling. Oh my God. You know, we sound like we're on LSD. You know, colors. We can actively take that quality of interest. It's so lazy the way it's interested, and just, oh my God, now I'm thinking this and that, and oh my God, right? It's lazy. That's the interest we're used to. It takes some effort to take that interest and place it into your physical senses. Some of you are talking about your experiences. Thank you, Eco Dharma Center. You know, thank you, nature, for providing us with all the nice inputs. So some of you are talking about looking at the rime ice, you know, or looking at, you know, the needles, conifers, just glaze with ice, you know. Fascinating. We can get fascinated. And then we're so happy. We don't need to take mind-altering substances. We can just really get into it, but we're so not in the habit. So again and again and again, we want our interest in our investigation to glom onto our five physical senses. And it's no big deal when you do this. You're only dropping out of separateness and stress and time and alienation and dropping into belonging, union, timelessness, satisfaction, fulfillment. Why are we so married to the thinking mind? It's maybe just a human thing. We're so used to just the stories. And it's like we're losing the art in our culture of just being in our senses. When we finally get there, we're just like, duh, you know? You know, some of you talking about retreat and resistance to retreat, and then you come on retreat. What was I thinking? Oh my God, so nice. It's that way with our physical senses. We just forget how happy we are when we're just in our senses. You know, and I won't remember the line verbatim, but, you know, Mary Oliver in one of her poems just talks about being idle and blessed and wandering around the fields and dropping to her knees, you know. And what else should I have done with my day, you know? Here's a poem I do have, Ria Khan, 18th century Zen dude. You'll hear his sensory awareness. The night is fresh and cool. Staff in hand, I walk through the gate. Wisteria and ivy grow together along the winding mountain path. Birds sing quietly in their nests. And a monk howls nearby. A monkey howls nearby. As I reach a high peak, a village appears in the distance. The old pines are full of poems. I bend down for a drink of pure spring water. There's a gentle breeze, and the round moon hangs overhead, standing by a deserted building. I pretend to be a crane, softly floating among the clouds. Here's another person, deep in their senses. This is Crowfoot, a Sisaka Indian from the 19th century, Native American, Native Canadian. What is life? It's the flash of the firefly in the night, the breath of a buffalo in the wintertime, the little shadow that runs across the grass and loses itself in the sunset. You know, it's like he's on retreat. I mean, you gotta watch a shadow a long time to watch it creep into the shadow of the sunset. So, we investigate our experience by being interested in the unfolding of it, watching the process of it, and remembering to take all that interest. We have to actively direct it towards our five physical senses. And we'll have insights. We'll have insights about content. Oh, so that's why I've been feeling this way about something, right? It's wonderful when those insights come. And those are just a great part of the practice. And the insight and insight meditation refers to something else. Not so much the personal insights, but the universal insights. So the personal insights are super important. And the Buddha taught the universal insights, and that's why all of this is so relevant 2,500 years later. So with investigation of dhammas, you know, investigation of what the Buddha taught, anyone recall, what are the three basic flavors of insight that we have when we really watch our experience? I know, more lists. But luckily, this is only three.
Pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral?
That's a great trio. And That's a profound one. So thank you for that. We'll add that into the mix. It wasn't the one I was thinking of. It's sort of, I guess, about as broad as we can get. But that's right up there with it. If I said the three characteristics, would you remember them?
Impermanence.
Mm-hmm.
Not a self and suffering.
Yeah. Okay. So impermanence, I'm going to slightly retranslate the words. Impermanence, unreliability, and not self. I want to talk about these three. So when we investigate how our experience unfolds, what we see is, oh my gosh, all it is change. And it changes in two ways. What we're observing changes, the objects change, but also we change what we're looking at. Even if you were to just look at something, so right now, if you just look at something ahead of you, and remember, attention is, you know, what you're focusing your mindfulness on. Notice that's changing too. The objects are changing, but our perception of objects is also changing. Nothing is holding still, and sight is the thing that looks the most unchanging. But when you look at your experience of sight, you see your experience of it is changing. Your mind is going to little different aspects of it flitting around. So our experience of everything is changing. And so we're not so much beings as we are flowings. Jack Kornfield likes to quote the cartoon of some Bedouins or, you know, some nomadic people on camels, and the children, the fathers turning to the children saying, "Stop asking when we're going to get there. We're nomads, for crying out loud." We never arrive. Everything is changing, and we're wanting to find that one state and then just park there forever. And there is apparently that one thing called Nibbana, where we can sort of park forever, but it's not parking like staying still. It's parking more like just being completely at peace with flow. So investigation, we direct it. You know, you want to kind of put that one to the test. Is this really true? And the Buddha said it. So we see for ourselves. Is everything changing? You know, don't take my word for it. Don't take the Buddha's word for it. Investigate. Find out for yourself. Really see if you can find something that doesn't change. Either the object doesn't change or your perceiving of it doesn't change. And what's wonderful about the three characteristics is it is actually the universe urging you to let go. It's the universe's way of teaching you to let go. It's super, super intense sometimes, the lessons in letting go and impermanence. And with people dying, close people that we've known and loved together, and each of us in our lives. That's a really intense teaching on impermanence. And it is what it is. It's a deep loss, deep. And what's so amazing is there is also a teaching. Teaching is let go. I mean, just seeing the the beautiful constellation of features that my mom was. And all of those features were together. You know, I've known her my whole life until she was done forever. It's just intense, intense teaching. But it is a teaching. It isn't just my mom died and it's terrible. It's like my mom died is terrible and it's a teaching on letting go. It's actually a bizarre and fierce kindness. And so impermanence, the flow of everything, the lesson in it is don't camp your happiness on something that's changing. I'll just quote Jimi Hendrix. Castles made of sand slip into the sea eventually. See, that's the mind just pinballing. Where did that come from? It's definitely not in my notes. That's impermanence. So we get a lot softer lessons that are more like atomized in our, through our day. Everything's changing. You know, the lentil potato curry. But it was just flow. You know, scrambled eggs. Just flow. Where is it now? You know, it's flow. Not everyone likes scrambled eggs. I missed that one, whatever it was.
Where is it now?
Oh, okay. It's still impermanent. It's definitely changed into something else. And the way the insights work is when we, through investigation... Oh, good. We're having a moment. Yay. Through mindfulness and investigation, when we see impermanence, we let go. Because you see, it's folly to try to grab like water, you know? It's folly to try to grab a stream or a waterfall. And you know, those of you who know me, you've heard me say this before, but to me it just seems so apt, so I will repeat it. We relate to experience differently. If we know it's a waterfall, oh, you're on a 5-day retreat. Oh, like it's a thing, you know? Like it's just like a ball, like sitting on a beach. It's not a thing. There's no such thing as a 5-day retreat. It's just water flowing through your hands. There's this, there's that, there's more of that, there's some of this, a little bit of something else, and now some of this, and then... It's tiring to have a little castle that only lasts about 3 seconds, you know, because then something else comes along. The ocean washes it away, so... So the way the universe is being kind to us is when we see our experience as a waterfall, we're going to relate to it differently. We might bathe in it, we might take a picture of the pretty rainbow, but we wouldn't lean on it. That would be folly. Leaning on a waterfall is silly. And that's the way insight works. It's silly to imagine you're going to park in a mood. You know, and some of you are talking about the grace that comes in your practice. Oh, there's just a moment or a little time where you're just totally here. And that's great. It's a sign that you're practicing, you know? But then you're wise enough to know, oh, but I don't want to be attached. Because it's water flowing through your fingers. Let it flow through, just don't lean on it. That would be silly. It would be silly to expect any state to stay. So, this leads to the second characteristic. So, again, this is the universe built somehow where if you're willing to pay attention and investigate, the universe is urging you to let go. And so the second characteristic is unreliability. And the word is dukkha, translated many different ways. It's the one I like the best. You often hear unsatisfactory. It means that which is changing can't give you the lasting peace, happiness, fulfillment you're seeking. It's unreliable. And we could translate that as suffering, but it gives the wrong impression, because it's not that we're miserable all the time. We are kind of restless a lot of the time. But we're attempting something reliable with things that are changing. So we don't want to lean on the waterfall. We don't want to rely on it, because it's not reliable. We can't lean on it. It'll change. I want to throw in a little humor about the unreliable. We can all, in this room, most of us anyway, relate to our unreliable brains and how our brains that used to be so smart and sharp, you know, are slowly getting a little harder to remember things. So, I don't know if I've read these to you or not. I think they're pretty good. So, a recent Twitter thread started by Paul Coxon, a physicist at the University of Cambridge, just started. He tweeted, Twittered out one of his brain farts senior moments where he forgot a really important word. So he is giving a presentation to his colleagues, and he forgot the word for photon, you know, about as basic a thing in physics as he could remember. So he called it a shiny crumb. And so he just couldn't remember the word. You know, this thing, a bunch of physicists in the room, yeah, what are you talking, a shiny crumb? Like, are you kidding? So he tweeted out that little senior moment. So then other people responded. I don't know how Twitter works, his friends or whatever. So a woman responded, and these are all academics, you know, very, very smart people. When I was pregnant with my first, I cried one day because I forgot the word banana. I described it to my then husband, you know, it's yellow. It comes in its own case. Kathy Hurst tweeted, I forgot the word articulate in an interview for a volunteer post, and instead said, I'm good at saying things. She's a lawyer. So, I'm a computer, Jason Frey, I'm a computer programmer with 20 plus years of experience. I bought a video game once, and the cashier asked me what kind of computer I had. My brain blanked, and I said, a white one. One of the guys I used to work with forgot the name for a tape measure. He called it a how far machine. And now it's in our everyday vocabulary. As a bilingual person, I forget words all the time, although my problem is I can often think of the word in the other language, but not in the one I'm speaking right now. I once had to describe pineapple as a hairy pear with a ponytail, because I couldn't translate ananas from French to English. here's the last. One of my clever... Wesley Martin tweets, one of my cleverest and most fabulous friends at university with a PhD in neuroscience once forgot the word for what she wanted in a restaurant and tried to explain with, you know, it's like a really, really wet salad. Soup. She wanted soup. Imagine the poor waitress trying to figure that out. All right, we've got to break up the dukkha with a little humor. So, the third characteristic, which is kind of just universal qualities of our experience, is not self, and we can really translate that as is non-essence. So nothing has an essence. When we're referring to us, we mean we don't have a self. And, you know, we've worked with this one a lot. Our ideas of things assume everything has an essence. There's an independent subject with an independent object doing an independent action. As if the three things are separate. You know, Alice threw the ball. Mary ate the cake, right? So our language just fools us. As if all of these things are separate and full of essence. So, Matthieu Ricard speaks to this. What we don't track through our traditional thinking is that everything is interrelated with and conditioned by everything else. So our language breaks everything apart. We don't understand everything is flowing in relation, conditioned by everything else. So Matthieu Ricard, who's been a Tibetan Buddhist monk, he's French. He was a French biochemist or molecular biologist, I can't remember. He studied little tiny things, you know, like little shiny crumbs or, you know, those little pieces of things in our body. So anyway, I think he's been in robes 40 or 50 years. So he writes this. A rainbow is formed by the play of a shaft of sunlight falling on a cloud of raindrops. It appears, but it's intangible. As soon as one of the factors contributing to it is missing, the phenomenon disappears. So the rainbow has no apparent nature of its own, and you can't speak of the dissolution or annihilation of something that didn't exist in the first place. That something only owed its illusory appearance to a transitory coming together of elements which aren't intrinsically existing entities themselves either. All phenomena are the result of a combination of transitory factors. This is the way enlightened beings relate to everything. The world is made of rainbows. Everything briefly appears, then gradually or suddenly disappears. Imagine how your relationship to the world would change if you realized it is all made of rainbows. You are sitting on a rainbow. You're holding a rainbow in your hands. You go to sleep on a rainbow bed and cover yourself with a rainbow blanket. You eat and drink rainbows. You put rainbow clothes on a rainbow body, and you make love to a rainbow mate. When your rainbow house disappears, it's no big deal. That's just what rainbows do. So, investigate this. Check it out for yourself. Does the metaphor track? Is your experience unfolding as discrete, independent, little things? Or is it unfolding as this web of complex, changing, interrelated, conditioned events? Investigate. See if the rainbow, see if you're less self and more rainbow. See if the meal, breakfast tomorrow, is less essence and more rainbow. You know? And soon there will be a walk, and then after that, a sit, and then after that, a sleep, and after that, or in that, maybe a dream. And then another sit. As if they're all things, when all they are is flow. And so this is investigation. Investigation is saying, look for yourself and see if it's true. And we're not, what's great is the Buddha's giving us pointers. Look for these three things. You know? Is my experience changing? If something is changing, is it reliable? I find this most interesting with food. Oh, brown rice. You know, in retreat, even brown rice starts to really taste good. You know? And we see it. Oh, brown rice, you know. Oh, salt, pepper, like the other day. You know, ooh, a little cheese on top, maybe. Dairy. Ooh. But then what's the experience? It's not, the experience isn't a thing, it's a flow in the mouth. And then it gets mushy. It's not quite as good as when it was, still had that little integrity of the little kernels. So now it's sort of turning into oatmeal. I better swallow. Okay. Dang. This was disappointing on a 2-month retreat. I started realizing, you know what? All that food, I'm sorry to say this. All that food that looks so wonderfully distinct and colorful with all these different flavors, it just turns into oatmeal in my mouth. And then I swallow. So what, and that was an insight of the unreliability of it. I had this big idea, ooh, it's this thing that's going to happen, and Spirit Rock, like, they serve some pretty amazing food. I mean, artichokes sometimes, whoa, wow. And yet, it's sort of like, it's nice. It's flowing. And so all of that, it's not trying to like disappoint you or upset you, is trying to point you at what's reliable. And what's reliable is the qualities in your heart of awareness and love. Everything else is saying let go. You can always come back to mindfulness and metta, awareness and love. Always available. If you remember the word sati, remember. Have to remember. So when we investigate the Dhammas, the capital D, the Buddhist teachings, that's one really important piece, is the three characteristics. And the other piece, which we've talked about a lot, is this notion of skillful or unskillful. And I'm starting to even like the words better, helpful or unhelpful. So there's desire that's helpful. There's desire that's unhelpful. There might even be anger that's helpful. Anger that's unhelpful. There's motivation for your practice that might be helpful and unhelpful. Basically, it's like, what works? What works for your own well-being and the well-being of others? So we can, and a huge part of the point of investigation is to really learn what's helpful and what's not. Because we say, you know, greed, aversion, delusion is the root of our trouble. And then you start to notice, well, greed is different from, say, aspiration or interest or enthusiasm, right? We start to really start to see how mind states work for me and how they don't. You know, when is desire connecting you to reality or disconnecting you from it? That's really, you know, what's helpful and unhelpful. There's desire that will really connect you to how things are. It's not the desire of wanting something other than what's here. It's the desire of wanting what's here, wanting to be here. So we've talked about this a bunch, so I don't think I need to say more. So all these wonderful qualities that are close to desire, interest, investigation, passion, excitement, enjoyment, love, loving the Dharma, all of that can be in service of you being here now. And then what about wonder or awe? To be in awe and wonder, as some of us are talking about being connected to the land this way. So here's a poem by Marcy Hans. She writes, "Fueled by a million man-made wings of fire, the rocket tore a tunnel through the sky, and everybody cheered. Fueled only by a thought from God, the seedling urged its way through the thickness of black, and as it pierced the heavy ceiling of the soil and launched itself up into outer space, no one even clapped." So we'll do our own clapping at all the little miracles we see around us. So let's sit for a minute.